From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Don't use the passive voice. Never end a sentence with a preposition. The way we teach grammar is scandalous, according to linguist Jeffrey Pullum. We nitpick too much, and we rely on old rules that have little application today. Pullum spoke about how we can fix this in a talk recorded at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on February 12, 2013.
I hope it is clear that I'm going to be talking not about bad grammar of people like you, but bad grammarians. This is about the gurus who don't know what they're talking about. This lecture is about them, because I think mainly people mostly get the grammar of their sentences just about right, nearly all the time. And they'd have to, really, because the ultimate arbiters of what's correct in a language have got to be the people who use it and know it. It's their language. All of the regularities about how it works stem from them. They couldn't come from anywhere else. They don't come from outside. They don't come from the cosmos or from powers on high or the authority of people who write grammars. The point about getting a grammar correct is that it does match what the speakers actually do. What's the scandal I'm talking about is the blundering nitpickers, the grumblers and writers of letters to the Daily Telegraph, and the pedants who actually are describing the language incorrectly and are using terminology and theory from 200 years ago. And they're making everything worse. And I'll try to really give you some evidence that it's not just that they've got stuff wrong, they're doing harm. The most common kind of grammar instruction you get in America particularly, I'm afraid it afflicts this country more than it afflicts the UK, and I'll come back to that point. It involves the transmission of what I'm going to call bogeyman rules. Just like the bogeyman, these rules are folkloric or legendary. They're not real. They're invented either deliberately or unintentionally, and there can be unintentional invention. They're propagated, in fact, mainly by educated and literary people, and their main purpose is to frighten the young. This is the sort of rule I'm talking about. Here's three at random that I won't even talk about in the body of the lecture. Never use like to introduce a clause. They'd say like is not a conjunction. You're not supposed to have anything like I said, or Marlboro tastes good like a cigarette should. Like is not to be used that way. You should use as instead. Since should only be used in the time adjunct sense, never to mean approximately because. So since yesterday is all right, but since this is true is supposed to be bad. I mean, to take that one as a random example, I once checked out the uses of since in David Hume's treatise concerning human understanding. There are 20 occurrences of since. 19 of them have the meaning because. Only one of them is temporal. That's how well this matches the English of one great philosopher. Don't begin sentences with a conjunction. So many English teachers have taught that. And just, I don't know how people could believe principles like this. They're not once valid grammar rules from earlier centuries. They were never principles of English sentence structure in the first place. They never matched any language that people spoke. The question is why people believe in them anyway. We're dealing with a sort of psychiatric puzzle here. So where do these bogeyman rules come from and who's transmitting them? Well, a little background. A long time ago, a student called Andy White took a writing class called English 8 at a college far away. And unfortunately, the events that stemmed from that have a lot to answer for. He was one of the most admired and influential writers at the New Yorker after a few decades under the name E.B. White. He wrote Charlotte's Web. Eudora Welty calls it just about perfect. And it really is a fine piece of writing. Do not imagine that I am saying that E.B. White didn't know how to write. It's wonderful writing. He didn't know how to talk about the grammar of the language he was using. That's the trouble. But in 1957, he wrote an article reminiscing about his memories of a professor, William Strunk, at Cornell, and the privately published little text that Strunk had written in 1918. Macmillan asked White to revise that for publication in 1957, and White agreed to it, and the result was The Elements of Style. It was a smash. Sales have exceeded 10 million copies. And the trouble is, what that little book says about style is mostly, I would judge, platitudes like be clear and omit needless words, which you don't need a book for that, really. I mean, it's again, don't imagine that I'm in favor of wordy, cloudy, bad writing. But you can get rid of that pretty fast. I wrote like that when I was first an undergraduate, and in my first quarter as an undergraduate, my first teacher of linguistics, an American, David Reibel, just took my first essay and he said, "You write like an 18th century clergyman." So I stopped doing that. I just got more clear. So that's all fine, but it's just basically a platitude. You don't need someone to tell you to be clear. Of course you'd be clear if you knew how. But Strunk and White concentrate quite a lot on giving actual rules of grammar that you're supposed to obey, and almost nothing they say about grammar is true. And the bogeyman rules they defend are actually harming the enterprise of getting people to understand sentence structure, which I think is tremendously important. This book is nearly a century old now, and it will not die. It has joined the undead. I sometimes think it'll live forever. The author, William Strunk, earned his PhD in 1896. You see the relevance of that date. That's 1 year before Dracula was published. And E.B. White was born in 1899. We're talking about a time when the 20th century hadn't even begun. These are not 20th century scholars with a sort of 19th century outlook. That's not what I'm grumbling about. These are 19th century men. In fact, when Strunk was born, there was no cross US railroad link at all. There was no Suez Canal. There was no Cutty Sark, the fastest of the clipper ships that sailed under wind power from India to Britain, had not been built yet. There was no Brooklyn Bridge. Lenin had not been born. Perhaps this is the kicker here. George Armstrong Custer was in the middle of a very successful military career and had years ahead of him. Now, don't misunderstand why I mention Custer. English has evolved a bit since Custer's last stand, so to a very small extent, Strunk, when he was growing up, before Custer's last stand, was learning a language that's not quite the same as what we speak today, but that really isn't the main point. My beef is that the knowledge we have about English has evolved a lot. We know a lot more about English grammar than we did then. Here's one little example. In a section headed, "The number of the subject determines the number of the verb," Strunk and White say, "With none, use the singular verb when the word means no one or not one." Notice it's quite uncompromising. It tells you what to do. And they give these examples. "None of us are perfect" is on the left marked as wrong. "None of us is perfect" is what you ought to write. Now, this is unbelievable. And I wonder if you can see why. Anybody who knows their English theater. Here we are in Act Two of The Importance of Being Earnest. Dr. Chasuble, on hearing Miss Prison saying, "As a man sows, so shall he reap," about the death of Jack's imaginary friend or imaginary brother, he is concerned that she's not being charitable. "Charity, dear Miss Prison, charity," he says. "None of us are perfect. I myself am peculiarly susceptible to drafts." That's Oscar Wilde putting this phrase, "None of us are perfect," into the mouth of Dr. Chasuble, a learned clergyman with a Doctor of Divinity degree. What on earth was Strunk thinking about? Is he suggesting that Oscar Wilde couldn't write decent English, or that he was putting uncouth, non-standard language into the mouth of Dr. Chasuble. This is ridiculous. But look more broadly, and we can do this so easily today. Here's Bram Stoker's fine epistolary novel of 1897. That's the right period to be thinking about. Strunk was a young man, and this was the sort of literature he could have been reading. I looked at all of the cases of none of pronoun in the book. There's just three where you can see agreement with the verb. And notice that all three of those, 100% of them, have plural agreement. It's just a falsehood that none of us or none of them always takes singular agreement. Why are they telling you you should write like that when nobody has for 100 years? There's actually some variation. Sometimes it's best to have the singular agreement. None of us is an idiot is better phrased with is because of the singular predicate. But none of us are perfect. This is a very apposite comment, and I want you to notice that it's from more than 100 years ago. Thomas Lounsbury saying there's no harm in a man limiting his own employment of none to the singular, but if he derives any pleasure from this particular form of linguistic martyrdom, but why should he go about seeking to inflict on others the misery which owes its origin to his own ignorance? That's the theme. I mean, if you just absorb that and realize how what an sensible point of view that is, we have the whole of this lecture already laid out for us. And Ben Zimmer quoted that on Language Log in 2008, and by then it was 100 years old. But writers are still pointlessly struggling to avoid violations of the bogeyman rule about none. Here's a recent example from The Economist, talking about people in Arctic cultures like the Inuit. None lives in an igloo these days. You can almost sense what happened to that sentence, which is not well phrased. First draft, none live in igloos these days. That's fully grammatical, but wait a minute. The rules say that none means no one, so we have to use singular agreement. All right, so let's change it to none lives in igloos these days. No, that's silly, because that's saying there's not one person who lives in a whole bunch of igloos, and that sounds silly. We'd better make igloos singular as well. So none lives in an igloo these days. Now we're going to talk about one. Oh, but we've got to publish. Let's just leave it at that. The language is botched, and apparently because they're struggling to avoid a stupid bogeyman rule. Hammering home the falsehood that noun phrases headed by none have to take singular agreement simply makes writers unjustifiably nervous and tends to make them write worse prose. And I take The Economist to contain generally extremely good prose. It's really sad to see it happening to them. I'll have a couple of more examples from The Economist later.
Jeffrey Pullum, a linguist and the author of The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on February 12, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Jeffrey Pullum in a moment. 820 94.9 KUOW. Guardian journalist James Ball talks about the darker side of his former boss, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. That's in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Also in that hour, the two biggest gangs in Honduras, sometimes called one of the most violent places in the world, agree to a peace deal. Again, that's tonight at 11 on As It Happens. If you've ever used the internet, email, a smartphone, iTunes, or almost any computer program, odds are you've agreed to a terms and conditions agreement without reading it. Film director Cullen Hoback takes a microscope to these labyrinthine contracts of rules and concessions, uncovering an epidemic of nearly invisible data mining, which allows multinational corporations and government agencies nearly unlimited access to our personal information. Is there any hope for the future of privacy? Hear Cullen Hoback talk about his documentary, Terms and Conditions May Apply. That's in the noon hour tomorrow. Ooh, boy. Lows around 50 tonight for the Seattle area, mostly cloudy, scattered showers this evening. Friday highs somewhere in the 60s, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny.
KUOW and Fremont Abbey Arts Center present Portland songwriter Kelly Schaefer, playing music from her new album, and Tacoma band Apartment Lights, Friday, May 31st at 8 p.m. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Grammar instruction in schools today is full of repetition and rules that are hundreds of years old. Linguist Jeffrey Pullum advocates a new way to teach grammar that he believes will enhance our writing skills. He's the author of The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on February 12, 2013.
Let's look at a different topic entirely. That of what linguists call stranding prepositions. Prepositions are these words like about and at and by and from and into and so on. I'll refer to the phrase that accompanies a preposition as a complement. So the movies is the complement in at the movies. And stranding is leaving a preposition on its own when its complement is grammatically required to be elsewhere in the sentence, typically at the beginning of the clause. As in, what were you two talking about? Or that sort of thing we haven't even looked at. Now, there's a long-lived myth that stranding is an error. And it really is a long time this myth has been around. We know the source. We can tie it down to the month. Defense of the Epilogue by John Dryden is in 1672. He's critiquing a passage from Ben Jonson's Catiline. Ben Jonson, great poet, was at the time more celebrated than Shakespeare. Ben Jonson is writing about the slaughter in Rome at the end of the Civil War. The rugged Charon fainted and asked the navy rather than a boat to ferry o'er the sad world that came. The maws and dens of beasts could not receive the bodies that those souls were frighted from. And even the graves were filled with men yet living whose flight and fear had mixed them with the dead. Very powerful poetry. And Dryden says, the bodies that those souls were frighted from. The preposition in the end of the sentence, a common fault with him, and which I have but lately observed in my own writings. Think about that. So stranding prepositions was natural for Dryden. He wrote sentences with stranding, just like Jonson did. What on earth makes him call it a fault? He doesn't say. But the damage he does is still with us. It really is in spades, and especially in this country. In Britain, nobody pays any attention anymore to the old myth. But for Americans, here's something from the New Yorker's search engine that I found in 2005 when I ran a search and there were no results. I'm sorry, I couldn't find that for which you were looking. That's so stupid, I'm putting an asterisk in front to indicate this isn't even a grammatical standard English sentence. It's so grotesquely awkward, it made me giggle. And I mocked it on LanguageLog, and within a week or two, they changed it. They read LanguageLog at the New Yorker. They changed it to something bland like, I'm sorry, there were no results. But they still wouldn't strand a preposition. They're terrified. Here's something from a computing director to staff at a U.S. university. Experiment a little to understand of what I am speaking, he says. Of what I am speaking. But that guy, I actually asked him very tactfully, was that a little joke about linguists? And I hoped I was right, and I was a bit aghast when he said, I was always taught that one should not put a preposition at the end of a sentence. He was very stiff and offended that I had asked. And he left the university within a few months after that and went to a Bible college in the Deep South. I've often worried about him. Dave Benelli is a New Orleans police lieutenant who was speaking to National Public Radio in December 2005 about the rash of unreported rapes in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. He says, defensively, we can only deal with that of what we know. Completely ungrammatical, that of what. But what he's doing is struggling not to say on National Public Radio, we can only deal with what we know about, or we can only deal with what we know of, because that would have a preposition at the end. He's struggling to avoid it and falling into such a mess that what he says is completely ungrammatical in his own native language. It's tragic. It's pitiful. I mean, looking at animals in pain here. And it's not, I'm not saying you get that with a New Orleans police lieutenant that doesn't have any education. Here's Annette and Jeffrey Chesky writing the liner notes on a recording of Handel's Messiah in, I think this one comes from Britain. And it refers to the original version of Messiah requiring a smaller orchestra than to which Handel was accustomed in London. Than to which? Completely ungrammatical, but they have done that struggling to avoid than Handel was accustomed to, which has a stranded preposition. People are really writhing and struggling to try and comply with a rule that John Dryden just invented off the top of his head in 1672 and had no reason for, and it never matched the language at all. One more example from a student's email to housemates. Thank you, awesome people with whom I reside and love. Now you see what's happened. If he'd said, people with whom I reside and whom I love, that would have been fine in very formal English because it fronts a preposition and you've got parallelism. And if he'd said much more reasonably, people who I reside with and love, it would strand the with preposition, and that would also be grammatical. But he was nervous, and he wrote an ungrammatical botch, even though only talking to other students. He was wrestling with dimly understood constraints, and he was losing. The bogeyman rule that people are trying to respect would say an occurrence of a preposition must be immediately followed by a noun phrase complement. And that's all very well for French and Spanish and Italian. It's true. It just isn't true for Icelandic, Norwegian, and English. You've got to take languages as they come, and some are different from others. These languages of northwestern Europe in the Germanic family strand prepositions. French doesn't, Latin didn't, but languages are different. What's so hard about that? Actually, in English, stranding is obligatory in many contexts. All of the following. In It's You That I Took It From, the one on the version on the right has an asterisk because it's completely impossible. That's the one I'm counting on. You can't get out of having the preposition stranded in these cases. They're the firm to buy it from. It's unclear what he's getting at. Who to give it to was unclear. Whatever I care for dies. Lament of an unsuccessful gardener. But you can't avoid the stranding preposition. What's it all about? How are you going to say that without stranding a preposition? About what is it all? All about what is it? There's no way to speak English like a normal human being and not strand prepositions. It's just a completely quixotic endeavor to avoid all stranding. You cannot do it. All writers of standard English strand prepositions. All the way down history, all of the writers named here. How many would be enough to convince people they should not worry about stranding prepositions? There's no experienced writer who follows it. Perhaps this is the absolute killer point. Lady Bracknell in The Importance of Being Earnest, the epitome of intimidatingly precise standard English of the upper-class British type that we're meant to be afraid of. She strands prepositions in at least three times in the script of the play. This is only 100,000 words, and she dominates, but she only appears in a few scenes. A very good age to be married at is her utterance. What did he die of? She asks about the imaginary friend of Algernon's. And about the French Revolution, I presume you know what that unfortunate movement led to. She's unembarrassed about stranding prepositions because she's an upper-class, confident speaker of standard English, and she knows that our language has this feature. She's got it right. Oscar Wilde depicts her as having it right. How could anybody doubt it? And yet, it is extraordinary how many people believe that there's something wrong with stranded prepositions. E.B. White offers some characteristically clueless remarks on the topic in his added chapter in The Elements of Style, the chapter 5, which is about style. He goes on about how you can use bad grammar a little bit if you know what you're doing, if you have a good ear for it like him. So, for example, to write a claw hammer, not an axe, was the tool he murdered her with, is good, because that's better than a claw hammer, not an axe, was the tool with which he murdered her, because it sounds more violent, more like murder. Good. A matter of ear. This man is telling us how to write. He is suggesting that when you murmur to your lover, tell me what you're thinking about. It sounds like murder. It sounds violent. It's ridiculous. How can people go on believing things that are so patently false and go on recommending this book? You know, there's more than 20 copies of The Element of Style sitting there on the shelf at Magus Bookstore. You could buy any one of them. I suggest you buy them and burn them. I would myself. It's an endless task. Let's look at a different topic. The same sort of lesson we drawn from it. Singular they. This is a delicious, lovely topic in grammar. The bogeyman rule about it was there in Strunk's 1918 version of The Elements of Style, long before White added his 2 cents worth and collaborated and revised it. He is rather perceptive. He begins imperceptibly by saying it's a common inaccuracy, the use of the plural pronoun when the antecedent is a distributive expression, like each or each one or everybody. He says that this requires the pronoun to be in the singular. But he notices that people are trying to avoid the awkward he or she, and sometimes to avoid committing to either of them, and thus concealing the gender of the person they're talking about. He says some bashful speakers even say, a friend of mine told me that they blah, blah, blah. Noticing that young men at Cornell in 1918 were sometimes a little bit embarrassed even to have a female friend at all and wanted to conceal the fact that they knew a female. It was a different age. You know. But he's noticed that it's very much a part of colloquial English. It's a natural feature of how we speak. The mistake he makes is calling it an inaccuracy and insisting that we shouldn't use it. Now, again, we can draw on Lady Bracknell to light our way. Here she is saying that she wants music that will encourage conversation at this reception she's running, particularly at the end of the season when everyone has practically said whatever they had to say, which in most cases was probably not much. If Lady Bracknell uses it, notice they has the antecedent everyone, which is morpho syntactically singular, that's why has the singular form, is agreeing with everyone. If she does it, it's grammatical. Deal with it. It's also indicative, very interesting point, that E.B. White's writing has instances of singular they. It's there in Charlotte's Web, characters saying things like, but somebody taught you, didn't they? So when he's writing his stuff, singular they naturally comes to his pen. And when he is in his mode of grammar guru pontificating about how you should write, you're meant to lay off it. They with singular antecedents actually goes back as far as Shakespeare and even Chaucer. And this is well known to the people who've actually looked at literature. What Strunker might recommend instead is the what the Cambridge Grammar calls purportedly sex-neutral he. And there's a lovely example of it on the back of the 3rd and 4th editions of The Elements of Style. Hard to imagine an engineer or a manager who doesn't need to express himself in English prose as part of his job. Are you feeling welcomed, girls, by the engineering and management? You feel that they expect you to join this? No, it's a stupid idea that his can be gender neutral. If that were true, you should be able to say things like, was it your father or your mother who broke his leg? And you giggle because that just sort of pulls the wrapper off and reveals how silly this is. Of course his doesn't mean his or her. It's a masculine pronoun. And using it and pretending that it covers females also is about as subtle as not having any female toilets in the engineering building. It's that stupid. English has traditionally used they as a sex-indefinite third-person singular pronoun for cases where reference is arbitrary or the antecedent is quantificational. Anybody who's done a logic course, what I mean is they is used as a bound variable when the antecedent is something like a quantifier. The purportedly sex-neutral he or she, for that matter, is a very poor alternative, and of course the disjunctions really are too clumsy, as I think Strunk realized. You really can't write a student who thinks he or she is smart enough to permit him or her to save himself or herself the trouble of stating his or her. Oh, please. Singular they is the optimal choice. The grammar grouches are just wrong about it, but they insist, and it is very difficult to get a singular they past any copy editor in America. At the very end, I'll come back to what that means about what we should be doing. First, a really profoundly copy editor friendly topic. Every copy editor works on this one. Which in relative clauses? There are two kinds of relative clause, the clauses that modify nouns. Restrictive or defining or integrated ones, the kind that don't have the commas, as in anyone who walks through that door. And the non-restrictive or appositive or supplementary relatives, the kinds that have to have commas. Bradshaw, comma, who just walked through that door, comma, where the relative clause there is a sort of parenthetical. With the first kind, the restrictive ones, you mustn't put commas, it ruins it. Anyone, comma, who walks through that door, comma, that just doesn't make sense. It's very important not to have commas in those cases, and it's also not right to leave them out for the non-restrictive kind. Bradshaw, who just walked through that door, disagrees. That needs commas. So there's two kinds of relative clause, and Strunk and White state this bogeyman rule: that is the defining or restrictive pronoun, and which the non-defining or non-restrictive. So they separate. They go with the two types. Now, there's a minor error there. That is not a pronoun at all. That's why you can't say the doctor to that I went. You can say the doctor to whom I went in formal standard English, but not to that, because it isn't a pronoun. It's a subordinator. It introduces subordinate clauses, and it introduces some relative clauses. Who is a pronoun, but that is not a pronoun. But the major error is that English never respected the alleged rule that you don't use which in restrictive relatives. Where did White get the rule from? Probably the King's English by Henry Fowler and his brother in 1906. But the Fowlers never actually said it was a rule. They admitted it's not easy to draw any distinction that's consistently supported by usage. No distinction can be authoritatively drawn between the two relatives. They admitted all that, and they gave examples of fine writers doing what they proposed should be regarded as the wrong way. But they knew that people were not following the recommendation they wanted to set up. They knew that the Holy Bible had phrases like "this thing which has come to pass." They probably knew that plenty of other writers had. William Strunk was one of them. In the 1918 edition, he wrote "the favor which you have requested," not "the favor that you have requested." And that's because everybody was. And when President Roosevelt, the day after Pearl Harbor, said that the date, December 7th, 1941, would be called a date which will live in infamy, he wasn't being ignorant. He wasn't getting English wrong. He used "which" because we do about 50% of the time. There's a variation between "which" and "that" in those cases. And all of literature confirms that.
Jeffrey Pullum, a linguist and the author of The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on February 12, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Jeffrey Pullum in a moment. Coming up to 841, 949 KUOW. In November of 2008, California voters enacted Proposition 8, a ballot proposition and a constitutional amendment, which stated that, quote, only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California, end quote. The validity of Prop 8 was subsequently upheld by the California Supreme Court, but a new organization called the American Foundation for Equal Rights challenged the ruling in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. On January 11, 2010, the trial of Perry versus Schwarzenegger opened under Judge Vaughn R. Walker, with high-profile trial lawyers and former rivals David Boies and Ted Olson joining forces in an unprecedented show of support for marriage equality. Dustin Lance Black's play, 8, faithfully recreates the progression of the trial through original court transcripts and interviews conducted with the plaintiffs, as their stories brought to life before a live audience. 8 by Dustin Lance Black, in an L.A. Theater Works production with an all-star cast including Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Martin Sheen, and directed by Rob Reiner. It's all tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. Lows around 50 tonight. Wouldn't 60 sound good, huh? Mostly cloudy, scattered showers this evening. Friday highs somewhere in the 60s, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny. A look at the mysteries scientists are exploring in the highly complex behavior of tree roots. That's right after the 9 o'clock news.
Join KUOW for the 2013 Seattle International Film Festival, now through June 9th. In its 39th year, SIFF is the largest film festival in the United States, showcasing 447 films from 85 countries this year. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Jeffrey Pullum is a linguist and the author of The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on February 12, 2013. Next, he continues talking about the rules of English grammar.
You've probably heard of split infinitives. I couldn't find a serious usage manual that even went near saying that split infinitives are bad. Nobody says they're ungrammatical. This is one of the cases where the people who believe they are respecting what it says in the books that you could see in the library if you went there haven't been there, because the books don't say that the split infinitive is ungrammatical. They all agree that it's grammatical. You can find Karen Elizabeth Gordon in a rather poppy little book called The Transitive Vampire saying, don't split your infinitives, they'd rather remain intact. That's the sort of way she writes. Which is a sort of bogeyman rule forbidding the famous example to boldly go where no man has gone before. And you can see E.B. White casting vague aspersions on split infinitives in a mealy-mouthed passage of his chapter 5, saying, you really have to know what you're doing, and you can if you're as clever as me, but I wouldn't advise it. The Economist Style Guide just recommends against them in a very mealy-mouthed way. They say it's actually very common, and there's nothing, no one would object it, but there's no reason to object to it, but some people are so annoyed by it that it's better to keep it out of the magazine. The cowardice, you know. But look, nothing is split in these examples. So first, the very term is completely misleading and wrong. Verb intensifying modifiers like boldly or really or at least are readily allowed at the beginnings of verb phrases. As you can see from be careful and try some, compared with you should really be careful now, or you should at least try some. These have modifiers at the beginnings of verb phrases. There's no reason why a verb phrase that then gets the infinitival to marker before it should be any different. If you can take be careful and put to in front of it, why not really be careful and put to in front of it? But it's not as if to be is a word. To sometimes occurs stranded, as in I don't want to. And be occurs on its own without a to, as in be careful. So it's not as if there's a word being split here. That's just a silly term. And the usage evidence is overwhelmingly clear. The sequence to at least try gets an estimated count of Google hits that's way up in the millions. They are, remember, large numbers of Google hits are always estimates, and they're often grossly wrong, but it's huge. And if you look for things like strong enough at least to try, they're vastly more rare. So what's actually happening in people who use the language, they are placing modifiers between to and the verb a lot. There's countless other ordinary, respectable, correct sentences like the ones on the screen now. Because it's often an excellent style decision. Good writers take the option whenever the meaning calls for it. And sometimes it's obligatory, as in, profits are expected to more than double. You can't say profits are expected more than to double. That makes it ungrammatical. The only place to put the more than there is in between the to and the verb. And what do you find in the classic literature of a century ago? In Stephen Crane's novel, The Red Badge of Courage, came out when Strunk was 26. Strunk, by the way, probably tacitly knew this. He doesn't mention split infinitives have anything wrong. All of these split infinitives occur in The Red Badge of Courage. All of these split infinitives occur in Dracula. There hasn't really been a time when split infinitives weren't occurring in literature, though the number grows down in some centuries. And yet even today, we find clumsy, desperate attempts to avoid splitting infinitives, like this one from The Economist, another example of why I say it's actually doing harm. A bill that would force any NGO receiving cash from abroad publicly to label itself a foreign agent is not quite clear enough, because it sounds like they might have meant receiving cash from abroad publicly, as if it was public recipients of cash that had to label themselves foreign agents. But they mean any NGO receiving cash from abroad to publicly label itself. The bill forces them to publicly label themselves foreign agent. It would have been much better to have the adverb after the to, but The Economist style guide in its cowardly way tells its writers not to, so they went with the less appropriate and clear style choice. And here's one case of something even more misguided. Here, there isn't actually an infinitive, but Joanna Trollope in Next of Kin writes, she had become used not to talking much herself. That's ungrammatical. It should have been, she had become used to not talking much. But talking is a gerund participle. That's not an infinitive construction at all. The not there is perfectly okay before the verb that it negates. Somebody, Joanna Trollope or her editor, seems to have moved the not under the mistaken impression that to have it after the to would be some kind of a split infinitive. Again, it's sort of wrestling with dimly understood constraints and losing and ending up with something ungrammatical. Here's a mythical constraint on pronouns. Can you see anything grammatically wrong in the sentence, Toni Morrison's genius enables her to create novels that arise from and express the injustices African Americans have endured? You can scratch your head for ages over that one and think, I can't see that's got a grammatical error. But Kevin Keegan, a teacher in Maryland, thought there was. And when he realized that the SAT was being marked with that treated as having no grammatical error, he was furious. He'd been teaching his students that there was a rule that this sentence violates. Louis Menand at Harvard agreed and criticized the Chicago Manual of Style, which has a grammar chapter now, for not including the relevant rule. What is the rule? It's a bogeyman. It seems to originate as recently as 1966 from Wilson Follett's Modern American Usage. It says that, the way Follett puts it, a noun in the possessive case being functionally an adjective is seldom a competent antecedent of a pronoun. Don't have a noun with the apostrophe S on it as the antecedent for a pronoun. The functionally an adjective is just a minor error of terminology. It's not the right term. But the major problem is this. No one could defend that rule from the evidence. Sentences violating it appear all the time in every kind of writing. Peter Skeldahl in The New Yorker. You can define El Greco's work by saying that what he did well, none did better. The Holy Bible, Joseph's master took him. David Skinner in The Weekly Standard, maybe Bush's utter lack of self-doubt that his detractors hate most about him. William Strunk, the writer's colleagues have greatly helped him. And Louis Menand himself, as Arnold Zwicky found by just taking down his copy of The Metaphysical Club. He found two on page 7, another one on page 25, more on page 28, 31, 38. When he got about half a dozen or more, he wrote to Louis Menand and said, "These are sentences, and very well-written sentences, from your own work. Why did you say in the New Yorker review that you wrote that there is this rule that you don't have pronouns with genitive noun antecedents?" And Menand responded rather haughtily that even if he had made some slips, it was important to obey these rules, especially if they're completely arbitrary, because it sort of keeps us in line. You can see what that. If this is the attitude, that it's better we should flog ourselves with these rules and be martyrs to them because it builds character or something, I don't know. But nobody naturally follows that rule in their writing. Even hard work by grammar bullies has failed to get anybody to follow it. It never matched any regularity of good writing. And it was wholly responsible for a whole SAT test being wrongly scored. And the SAT people caved when they had this teacher from Maryland insisting there was this rule. They didn't know it was just a bogeyman rule. They thought they'd better change everyone's scores. So he appealed again, because he said, now, since what had happened was they were marking both answers as right. If you said no error, that was treated as correct. And if you said there's an error here in the pronoun, that was correct. Kevin Keegan appealed again, because he said, my students should have been graded higher because they had the right answer. You're now giving them okay on the wrong right answer, and that's not good enough. So he was still not satisfied. What a time-wasting piece of nonsense. Most of the SAT grammar questions have this awful property that in order to answer them correctly, you've got to be able to read the mind of the examiner and decide whether they're expecting you to be sensible and say, no, this is fine, split infinitives occur in decent literature, or whether they're expecting you to finger it as bad because you know you ought to. Horrible. One more topic that could easily be the subject for a whole hours of lecture, which I would love to give you, but I'm not allowed. The passive. Use the active voice, said Strunk. Never use the passive where you can use the active, said George Orwell in his awful essay, Politics and the English Language. As a rule, avoid the passive voice, say Fursten and Stedman in the 1931 book, and most extreme I've ever seen. A sentence written in passive voice is the shifty desperado who tries to win the gunfight by shooting the sheriff in the back, stealing his horse, and sneaking out of town. This is Sherry Roberts in a completely mad statement in 11 Ways to Improve Your Writing and Your Business by listening to arrant nonsense from somebody who doesn't know grammar from a hole in the wall. One result of advice of that sort, don't use the passive. This is an actual facsimile of a scan of an essay written at a great university far away where a TA was marking history essay, and everywhere it says PV, like there, it means passive voice, right? And was obviously very interested is marked, was quite brilliantly using the vacancy is marked, innocent was also reluctant to mention, that's marked as passive voice. It was relatively easy to passive voice. People were opposing the official viewpoint. You can see that's straightforward transitive use of opposing, but it's marked here as passive voice. The TA apparently thinks that anything with the verb be in it, anything with was or is passive. Here, something is marked awkward. Innocent saw his people taken from him by the Waldensian heresy. Taken from him by the Waldensian heresy actually is a passive, but the TA didn't notice. The church was corrupt. Oh, that's passive. Practices were more and more notorious. I counted them up everything, and the TA is wrong about passives 70% of the time. And there's nothing wrong with any of this writing. It's just perfectly good undergraduate writing. The person to whom this was done still has that history essay in his possession and still resents this abuse. And I can see why, because that's what it is. We're having people who don't know what a passive is and can't tell passive from active, paid money to go over essays and mark perfectly good sentences in the active voice as passive to damage undergraduates' confidence in their writing and make them unhappy. And they pay tuition for that. I mean, it's just shocking. Just shocking. Let me sum up. What I'm saying is that what passes for grammar instruction today is often just ignorant parroting of bogeyman rules that never held for the language at any point. The main practical effect of these bogeyman rules is to damage people's confidence in their writing and leave them in a state that I've called nervous cluelessness. As a result, writers, and this may mean many of you who have to, if you have to write as any, a part of your job and you have a boss who might look at the stuff and critique it, you may face a difficult and unfair dilemma. If you yield to the grammar bullies, you may risk sounding stiff or pompous as you have to write with whom instead of stranding a preposition and so on. If you defy them, you're going to risk censure from the nitpickers, right? So you have to be either a coward, like The Economist, which says, let's not use split infinitives, people might get angry. Or you have to sound stiff and pompous when you didn't want to. If you don't risk being dinged for bad grammar by idiots who don't know what is bad grammar, you're going to sound stiff and pompous in some cases when you didn't want to, or make things less clear by not splitting infinitives. It's a miserable position to be in. All I can say that offers any hope is that you can be a bit less cowed by the grammar bullies if you know something about the facts. And that connects to this point. I think everyone who gets a college degree should take at least one linguistics or English language class. Anything like structure of English, languages of the world, linguistic theory, almost any would have some effect in helping you to see that you can look at language scientifically. And it's sort of inspiring. You become better acquainted with what is already one of your most remarkable achievements. You've mastered your own native dialect, and it's an incredible feat to be able to speak a human language, one that no animal can emulate in even a tiny bit, not even a tenth of 1% of what we can do. None of it. The grammar bullies with their bogeyman rules are never going to go away, but they will have less of a hold over you once you know a bit more about language than they do. And since they're so ignorant about their subject and it's so easy to refute them, that's not an unreasonable goal. That's my bottom line. Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Pullum, a linguist and the author of The Cambridge Grammar of the English Language. He spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on February 12, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Kongsgaard Goldman Foundation, the Kate Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions.